From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Richard Brelinger collects films that even the creators didn't think were worth saving. Short films from the 30s, 40s, and 50s like Are You Popular?, Dating Do's and Don'ts, A is for Adam, and Good Wrinkles, The Story of a Remarkable Fruit. He's curating an exhibition of some of these educational, social guidance, and industrial films at the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York. On today's Fresh Air, we find we can learn a lot from these films, although it's not what they were intended to teach us. Also, the creator of The Today Show and The Tonight Show, we meet Pat Weaver. He was head of programming for NBC in the early 50s. He writes about the early days of TV in his new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A broadcast report from a Boston television station says an arrest warrant has been issued for figure skater Tanya Harding and four men in connection with the attack on rival skater Nancy Kerrigan. But Detroit's deputy chief of police says that he has no information that Harding is connected to the attack. Meanwhile, a spokesman from the Multnomah County, Oregon Sheriff's Office has told a Portland radio station that Harding's bodyguard is one of the people sought in arrest warrants issued today. President Clinton and President Yeltsin spoke twice today at the Kremlin. This is the first day of their Moscow summit. At the top of the list was the new NATO Partnership for Peace arrangement that offers limited alliance membership to former Soviet bloc countries. The BBC's Jeremy Harris reports from Moscow.
Mr. Clinton wasted no time in highlighting the NATO plan approved earlier this week for developing links between the alliance and former communist states to the east. His task? To persuade a beleaguered Mr. Yeltsin that the plan will not leave Russia isolated, nor prove a political liability if accepted. A spokesman for the Russian president said the idea merited deep consideration. Sharing the summit focus with hopes for a new security relationship were various remnants of the old one. American reports here indicate Russia and the United States have concluded a deal to stop targeting each other with thousands of long-range nuclear missiles. The agreement could be announced formally tomorrow, when Russia, Ukraine, and the United States sign a three-way deal to eliminate the world's third-largest nuclear arsenal by removing all nuclear weapons from Ukrainian soil.
Jeremy Harris reporting. The Pentagon is unveiling new rules aimed at expanding opportunities for women in the military. Defense Chief Les Aspin is releasing the guidelines which would permit women to join combat units, with only a few exceptions involving the Army and the Marine Corps. Aspin says it's time for the risk rule to be lifted.
Expanding the roles for women in the military is the right thing to do, and it's also the smart thing to do. It allows us to assign the most qualified individual to each military job, which is very, very important when what we really rely on is the high quality of our personnel as the keystone to the effectiveness of the United States military in the new era.
Under the new guidelines, women would still be banned from units that face hostile fire. The government says retailers saw sales increase 0.8% in December. That's the ninth monthly rise in a row. The Commerce Department says retail sales for all of last year climbed 6.2%. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 6.5 points at 3,842. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The French government got a setback today when a court ruled that a bill on school funding is unconstitutional. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The proposed legislation would have repealed a 19th-century law limiting state spending on private schools. Most of them are Catholic. Under the proposal, local communities could have subsidized private and public schools on an equal ratio. The law was passed by Parliament, but today the French Constitutional Court said it's unconstitutional. This ruling is certain to please socialist President François Mitterrand, who criticized the proposed law. His remarks were the sharpest he's voiced yet against the conservative government of Prime Minister Edouard Balladur. Left-wing groups have planned to protest the law on Sunday. They say the demonstration will go ahead anyway, despite the ruling. They plan to make a show of force against the government. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Coast Guard says more oil is leaking from a tanker that ran aground off Puerto Rico last week. The service says more oil started spilling early today when high waves began washing against the vessel. A Coast Guard spokesman says there's no estimate of how much more oil has poured out of the ship, but he says it is significant. Globs of oil are washing up on beaches in San Juan. Authorities have brought in more cleanup equipment. The Coast Guard says that it wants to tow the barge 20 miles away from Puerto Rico, pump out the rest of the oil, and then sink it. GTE Corporation says it will cut 17,000 jobs in its telephone operations business over the next 3 years. The firm also plans to take a $1.8 billion charge in the fourth quarter this year. It's pre-tax and will be used for restructuring purposes. The phone company says the charges will reduce its fourth quarter net income by $1.2 billion. The restructuring will include improving customer service. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Remember all those films you were shown in school that were supposed to teach you how to be a well-adapted, productive member of society with good hygiene habits and a willingness to defer to authority? How about those old industrial films designed to sell luxury cars and deluxe refrigerators? Rick Preilinger has over 25,000 educational and industrial films in his archive. Films like Are You Ready for Marriage? Girls Beware! What It Means to Be an American, and The Wonderful World of Wash and Wear. He's curated an exhibition from his archive, which runs through the end of the month at the American Museum of the Moving Image in New York. MTV, HBO, and the Comedy Channel often use his films for camp value or to help establish a period. We asked Preilinger to join us, along with his colleague Ken Smith, who's researching the history of these films for a book he's writing. Let's start with an excerpt of the 1956 film Once Upon a Honeymoon, produced for Bell Telephone to sell new color phones. A newlywed wife sings about the kitchen and living room she dreams about.
Hello, yes, this is Mary. How are you? Bye.
They say your kitchen dazzles every eye.
A brand new sink, a built-in oven, a new refrigerator and a phone, a kitchen phone, a bright red phone. I gotta go, goodbye, goodbye, goodbye. I'll call you later. Wish my living room were all redone. New drapes, new rugs, oh, this is fun. It's nice to have a telephone to blend with my new drapes and rugs. A living room that's all our own.
Rick Preilinger, what are we listening to?
Once Upon a Honeymoon is a Hollywood musical, but it's only 14 minutes long, and it was made to sell color telephones to the American public back in the 50s when they first became available. But Once Upon a Honeymoon is more than just a simple sales film. It flirts with fantasy and unreality, and also we're at a time when the telephone is no longer a necessity, that it's become a decorative accessory in the home. And you know, things like whim and choice and taste enter in for the first time.
Who was supposed to watch Once Upon a Honeymoon?
Once Upon a Honeymoon, like many of the sponsored films, was made to show a little bit in theaters, but mostly to kind of captive audiences and community groups and schools. And it was also made to show on TV in the days when the networks didn't run all the time, and there were a lot of holes in the schedule. So stations begged for films that had entertainment value.
Let me play an excerpt from another film in the Preilinger archives, and this is called Shy Guy. And in this film, a teenage boy is in his basement rebuilding radios and working on his oscilloscope, and he's afraid he doesn't fit in. So his father, dressed in his business suit, comes down into the basement and gives his son advice about how to fit in at school and how to become more popular like the other boys.
You know, when we moved here this summer, I had quite a time making friends in a new office where everybody else knew each other.
What'd you do, Dad?
Well, that's beside the point, son. What works for one doesn't necessarily work for another.
But I bet the other men didn't look at your clothes all the time.
Well, what makes you think they look at your clothes?
Oh, because the other fellas wear sweaters or just shirts, not a regular suit like mine.
Well, wear a sweater then. The clothes alone won't... Phil, what about the other fellows? What do they do? What do they like?
Gosh, Dad, I don't know. I never noticed. Only I know it's not radios.
Perhaps that's the reason you don't know. You don't notice what the others are interested in. Why not try to find out?
How, Dad?
Well, you might try watching, listening. Pick out the most popular boys and girls in school and keep an eye on them. Try to figure out why people like them. Not that you'll ever be just like any of them, but you might learn something.
Now, where is this movie from?
That film was made in 1947 by Coronet Films. Coronet was one of the biggest, in fact, the biggest producer of social guidance films at that time. Social guidance films came in after World War II because parents and educators were very concerned that the kids at that time would become another lost generation as they had after World War I. So they decided to use the most modern scientific teaching tool they had available, and that was film. And so they made hundreds of social guidance films, and Shy Guy was one of the first.
This film and several other films that I've seen from your collection seem to be intent on teaching family values, teaching how you're supposed to behave with your peers and how you're supposed to behave with your family.
Well, that's very true. They were trying to teach kids how to not be adults as they had been during the war. There was again a great fear that that kids would get out of control. And Shy Guy's notable. Well, it's notable for a couple of reasons. First of all, it stars Dick York in one of his earliest appearances.
The co-star of Bewitched.
Yes. And second of all, it was probably the first film that encouraged kids to look around them and try and fit in with their peers. This was a theme that ran through many of the social guidance films, and actually it kind of backfired because while adults were trying to get kids to fit in, what the kids were really doing were listening to each other instead of the adults.
And, that's an interesting point.
And then once the late 50s came around, things kind of got out of control.
Do you think the secret message of this film is conformity?
It was. It was definitely, to conform was to be safe. To fit in was desirable. You didn't want to stand out. Standing out meant you were different and weird, and they didn't want that.
There's a real sense in the post-war social guidance films. I should say, by the way, that we have about 180 of them. This was a huge behavioral offensive. But there's a real sense of breeding out the unusual, of kind of normalizing interaction between people and within families and making behavior predictable.
Well, that leads me to another film in your collection, A Date with the Family. And this film is supposed to show you how a good nuclear family should handle family dinner when Dad comes home from work. And the emphasis is on how family dinner can be warm and fun if everybody cooperates and participates. Why don't we hear an excerpt?
Well, the dinner date has begun, and they're all happy about it. Napkins on the lap, the family awaits service. They converse pleasantly while Dad serves. I said pleasantly, for that is the keynote at dinner time. It is not only good manners, but good sense. Pleasant, unemotional conversation helps digestion. Father serves mother first, then daughter. Then the boys. Don't worry, fellas, you won't get left. By example, older children can teach younger ones good table manners. No one starts eating until father has served himself. Always wait for the hostess, in this case mother, to begin eating before you start. Let father and mother guide the conversational trend if they desire. After all, they made all this possible and may want to talk over their day with each other. Tell mother how good the food is. Maybe sis rates a compliment too. It makes them want to continue pleasing you.
Now, when is this film from? And is this one of those social guidance films?
This is another social guidance film. It was made in 1950. Actually, it looks like it was made probably about 1930. Style is so stilted. It's also very typical in that the actors have nothing to say. It's completely without live sound. It's all done with a narration. And that was very typical of social guidance films. It was this kind of, you know, omnipotent voice of God. And what a child was supposed to do, you weren't supposed to think for yourself. There were just a certain set of rules. And once you memorized those rules, that's all you needed to know. Then you would fit in, and then life would run very smoothly, and you'd be very happy.
I think this film shows how much discontent must have been seething beneath the surface. Because if you had to make movies to convince people that family dinner could be fun, family dinner could be a good thing, it had to mean that a lot of people were really alienated from family dinner.
Well, you know, that film actually proposes that you lie and that you be dishonest, that you greet your dad as though you were genuinely glad to see him, as though you really missed being away from him.
Implying that you weren't genuinely glad to see him.
Right, and implying that the best family values, so to speak, are based on not speaking frankly to one another. One of the secrets which I think these films reveal is that the 50s were a time filled with discontent and paranoia, not the 50s with a warm, soft glow as it's sometimes portrayed in the media.
My guests are Rick Prelinger, who collects ephemera films in his archive, and Ken Smith, who's writing a book on these films. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Rick Prelinger and Ken Smith. Rick Prelinger, how did you start collecting these films? I never would have thought that somebody was amassing these films that everybody has forgotten.
I began as a film researcher about 10 years ago, working on a project about sex and romance at mid-century. And very quickly, I discovered this whole universe of films, at first social guidance films, later on the rest of the educationals and advertising films, that nobody knew about, that were not saved anywhere. You had to maybe go to the producers, you had to go to audiovisual centers that had closed down, sometimes even dig in dumpsters. But there were still some there. And as time went on, I began to assemble a fairly large collection. You know, when you have one or two, there may be a gem and they may be particularly revealing. But when you begin to put a lot together, the big themes begin to come out and you begin to see, you know, that there are authors and that there's voices and there's some very interesting things to see in these films.
What are some of the big themes that have emerged? And you've collected education films, social guidance films, industrials.
All of those. We also, in the last few years, have started to collect amateur movies, home movies, because they're tremendously revealing about everyday life, the look of people and places. One of the themes which I think is most interesting is kind of the grooming of the perfect American consumer over time. The American consumer was constructed by some major corporations over time, and there's a lot of revealing evidence about how this was done in the films, how desire was created, how model buyers and model families were presented for us to emulate.
A lot of these movies precede television advertising.
That's correct, and in fact, early TV commercials took a great deal of their stylistic inspiration from some of the old one-minute movies that used to show in movie theaters.
So when companies made industrials advertising their new products and showing what you were supposed to want next, who would they show it to?
There was, until recently, a fairly well-established circuit for showing sponsored films around the country. And it was an incredibly inexpensive means of reaching the public with a message that didn't last 30 seconds or 1 minute, but maybe 10 minutes or half an hour. Films like We Drivers, a safety film made by GM with a little bit of advertising in it, were seen by over 30 million people.
Where did they see them?
In the old days, they were shown in theaters, especially the newsreel theaters that used to clutter up downtown areas. They're gone now. In schools, in 4-H groups, granges, on shipboard, in prisons, women's groups.
Rick, when you decided you were going to start collecting these films, where did you go to get more of them? And were people willing to give them to you?
I was quite... First, I was surprised that many of these films still existed. Conventional film archives have devoted their attention to preserving threatened masterworks, nitrate feature films, let's say, and to a limited extent, newsreels. But there was no archive to go through for these. A lot of the people who had worked in some of the production companies had felt that these films were too valuable to throw away. They didn't know why they were saving them, but they were very pleased that I was interested in bringing them into an archive. Some of them came from colleges and high schools who had gotten rid of film and shifted over to video and had closets full of films that were declared surplus. And then I guess maybe the most interesting source is from, you know, this is a nation of pack rats. People don't like to throw things away if they have any room, and sometimes even if they don't. And quite often people will have films in their attics or their basements, and they perceive that they're of some value, but they don't really know what to do with them. And, you know, oftentimes we're lucky to hear from those people.
Have you found a lot of producers, directors, actors who made industrials in the early part of their career and then became better known for Hollywood or television work?
Yes. Of course, we've already mentioned Dick York and Shy Guy, the man who narrated that film. His name is Myron Walashinsky, and of course, we know him better now by his new name, which is Mike Wallace.
Are you kidding?
That's where he got his start. We're showing a film in our series called Freedom Highway, which was the first film that Angie Dickinson was ever in.
Wow.
So yes, it was a stepping stone for quite a few people because there were so many of these films made. Hundreds of thousands of these kinds of films were made. And any actor or narrator who wanted to support himself or herself, you know, did these films just to feed themselves.
I was also going to mention that... Robert Altman got a start as a director at Calvin in Kansas City, and he made one film which we have, which is astonishing, called The Magic Bond for VFW, which has a scene in it of GIs sitting around in a foxhole, and it looks just like MASH.
Some of the films in your archive seem to be odes to the factory assembly line or exhortations to workers to get out there and work with good spirit and be productive. They almost remind me of what I think of as, like, you know, communist propaganda films, but instead of being about communism, they're about capitalism.
Well, I think that's very true. I call some of these films examples of capitalist realism because, in fact, the techniques of the Soviet cinema are being used to promote the American system here. From Dawn to Sunset, which is a film made in 1937, was made by General Motors right after the United Auto Workers successfully organized the first plants in Flint and around Detroit. And in a way, it's an attempt to deny that unions exist, because what it does is it shows a kind of circular relationship between workers and the company for whom they work. Workers become consumers rather than dare I say, a class with any interests of their own. And it's by omission, I think is trying to imply that unions are an unnecessary force.
Why don't we hear an excerpt of From Dawn to Sunset?
Follow the eastern sun as it rises on the homes of men along the great Atlantic seaboard. The morning light over the plains has waked the thousands who are off to enliven the factories of the vast Midwestern states. And along the sunny shores of the Pacific, men are on their way to quicken the beat of industry. In 12 great cities, located in every region of the country, the clans are gathering for the work of a new day. As the sun stretches fingers of light across the pavements, the early morning sparkles with the greeting of men to men. On their way to factories in Flint and Atlanta, from Tarrytown to Oakland, the neighborly workmen hail each other with the salute of fellowship.
Do you think of this as a propaganda film?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. It was thrown together out of a lot of stock footage just months after the first union contract was signed. One of these days, you know, the background of a lot of these films is fascinating, and nobody's really done the historical research, you know, to try to go back to corporate records and see if there's memos or information about this. But I think that we'll find that it's a propaganda response on GM's part.
Do you each have any personal favorites in the thousands of films in the Prelinger archives?
Well, my favorite social guidance film is probably I think everybody else's favorite, which is a film called Dating Do's and Don'ts. It was a film made by Cornette in 1949, and it basically takes you through a date step by step, presenting you with various alternatives as to the way you want to act. I mean, at the end, you know, Woody, who is the lead, he has the option of either lunging for the woman who he's saying goodnight to or shaking her hand. And of course, when he lunges, he's spurned, and when he shakes her hand, he is congratulated and walks off at the end whistling very happily.
Rick, what about you?
Well, I was sitting trying to think of a specific film, and I can't. I guess what I would say is I'm most fond of the films which seem to have some kind of inconsistency in them, where what you see is not the same as what you hear. For example, in Dawn to Sunset, which we were talking about, you hear about how these workers are happy and earning money and living the good life, but you see, you know, the demeaning and the dangerous nature of the work that they're doing. So you're really forced to kind of resolve that discontinuity in your mind.
Have you come across any of the movies that you actually remember from your youth? Have you come across them in the collection?
I found a good many, actually. I mean, I remember the one on artificial respiration where people people run to the pool to revive the kid. And, of course, I remember the wonderful Frank Capra science films like Our Mr. Sun and Hemo the Magnificent.
Oh, I remember Hemo the Magnificent.
Yeah,
sure.
Ken just turned those up in the shelves the other day.
we keep
finding stuff. It's out of this collection. I've seen perhaps 2,000 films. Ken's maybe seen another couple thousand. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, 18,000 more, 20,000 more to look at.
You could probably watch these films for the rest of your life and not watch your whole collection.
It's a life sentence, I suppose.
It is indeed.
But you know, it beats working, and your sense of history begins to, it's constantly reworking and rewriting itself.
But you know, it's so interesting because you're looking at a phony presentation of life that is actually very revealing about what real life was.
Well, you know, historians have often been caught up in kind of a trap of authenticity. If it isn't, you know, an exact record of a real historical event, it isn't important. And I would argue on the contrary that these films are all about what we received from the top down, how the media sent messages to people, how we were conditioned, trained, taught, and sold to, and what our aspirations and our feelings were over time. And I think that that's very important because the history of the 20th century is to a great extent the history of the mass media. In addition, these films are also very interesting because they do picture life as it was. You can see the look of a street. Mm-hmm. And you can see average and ordinary families, and you can see, you know, very rich visual imagery that contains a lot of information. You wouldn't see it in a feature film that was more stylized. You wouldn't see it in a newsreel or an old TV show.
It's very true. The as strange as these films may look to us now, and as stilted and as unreal, the producers made a very conscious effort to reproduce reality as closely as they could. In order to make the messages of the film more acceptable. So while we may look at them and shake our heads in disbelief, at the time they were considered much more real than anything, of course, that Hollywood was producing.
Right. Well, I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Rick Preilinger is the founder of the Preilinger Archives. His colleague Ken Smith is writing a book about ephemera films. Preilinger curated an exhibition of films from his archive. The show runs through the end of January at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I can't get over it sometimes, how teenagers can be such suckers. Do you know what a sucker really is? Ask any carnival pitchman. The sucker is the guy who thinks he's smart, that he's putting something over on you. Take the old shell game. The sucker never wins. Why? Because the pea is really a ball of wax. It's never under the shell. It's under the...
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the creator of The Today Show and The Tonight Show. We talk with Pat Weaver, one of the early heads of NBC TV. When he joined the network, the programs were produced by the advertisers, a system he did away with. And when did the world get to be such a dangerous place for children? Writer Anne Lamott worries about keeping her son safe from harm. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The two houses of the new parliament in Russia are getting down to business. One chamber has chosen a chairman, but the other is still working on it. NPR's Brooke Gladstone reports from Moscow.
The upper chamber, the Federation Council, managed after several tries to select a speaker. Yeltsin ally Vladimir Shumenko was chosen to conduct the meetings of that body. But in the midst of candidate discussions in the lower house, the Duma, chaos erupted yet again, instigated by the ultra-nationalist party leader Vladimir Zhirinovsky. He angrily withdrew his candidacy for speaker, saying he'd rather prepare for the 1996 presidential election. He told his Duma rivals to shut up and that they would find themselves in mental hospitals when he took office. Zhirinovsky predicted he would have 90% of the Russian people behind him by this fall and that the world would take note. I scared everyone on the planet during my 2 days in Europe, he said, referring to a recent trip. The world is now ready to pay billions to Russia. This is Brooke Gladstone in Moscow.
U.S. officials say Presidents Clinton and Yeltsin have agreed to stop aiming nuclear missiles at each other's countries. Both leaders reportedly will sign an agreement tomorrow getting rid of the Cold War practice. The officials say the agreement calls for all but a few of the missiles to be deprogrammed, and the few that are left will apparently be aimed at uninhabited ocean areas. Although the agreement is significant, it's mostly symbolic because the missiles could be re-aimed at the United States and Russia in just minutes if necessary. The Clinton administration has chosen Thomas Constantine to head the Drug Enforcement Administration. Constantine is superintendent of the New York State Police. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Attorney General Janet Reno described Thomas Constantine as a street-smart officer who worked his way up through the system, taking no shortcuts. Constantine has a long track record in drug trafficking investigations. His nomination was an opportunity for the White House to beef up its crime fighter image. The heads of virtually every federal law enforcement agency were present, along with Vice President Al Gore.
The reality of the crime and fear now spread to every corner of our land. As we gather here this morning, people are being killed by drugs. And there can simply be no excuse for letting it continue.
A major focus of DEA policy will be increased cooperation among all levels of law enforcement. Constantine's nomination now goes to the Senate for confirmation. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
NASA says the Hubble Space Telescope is fixed. NASA's administrator says the repair mission succeeded beyond NASA's expectations. But he's warning scientists still have years of testing ahead of them, and he can't predict if all the instrument's planned scientific experiments will succeed. Stocks close lower today on Wall Street. The Dow lost 6 points to end at 3,842. Trading was quite heavy. This is NPR. More than 500 economists have signed an open letter to President Clinton, finding fault with his proposed health care reform plan. The letter says the reforms will hurt the quality of the nation's health care. The economists want the president to take price controls out of his suggestions. They warn that price controls could lead to shortages of health care. Meanwhile, the New York Times says the American Medical Association will fight parts of the plan that harm doctors. The AMA reportedly will seek 37 changes, most of them involving pocketbook issues. There's been another train derailment in central Florida. Officials say a circus train jumped the tracks near Orlando. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
The train belongs to the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus and was on its way to Orlando for a weekend performance. A spokeswoman for the circus says that as many as 19 of the 59 cars jumped the tracks near Lakeland, Florida. That's about 60 miles from the gates of Walt Disney World. Polk County Sheriff's deputies say about 200 people were on board the train, dozens were hurt, and at least one has died from the wreck. None of the animals on board apparently got loose. Emergency crews are on the scene, and there's no word yet on what might have caused the train to derail, although the area is shrouded in fog. Last November, an Amtrak train jumped its tracks near Orlando after it had collided with a tractor trailer that was stalled at the crossing. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
The government says inflation was a moderate 2.7% during 1993, the smallest gain in 7 years. The Labor Department says the small rise was due to flagging energy and tobacco prices and the smallest increase of medical costs in 20 years. The agency says inflation ran at 2.9% in 1992 and 3.1% in 91. The government says this is the best 3-year inflation performance since the mid-60s. Many analysts expect inflation probably won't be a problem this year either. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. The Today Show and The Tonight Show, two of the longest-running shows in TV history, were created by my guest, Pat Weaver. He also launched Your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar and Wide Wide World. He joined NBC TV in 1949 and was president of the network from 1953 to 56. His new memoir, The Best Seat in the House, is about the early days of radio and TV, but he occasionally digresses to discuss his now-famous daughter, Sigourney. Before joining NBC, Pat Weaver worked in advertising, and in those days, advertisers virtually produced the programs on radio and TV. In his years with the ad agency Young & Rubicam, Weaver wrote and produced for Fred Allen, Jack Benny, Burns & Allen, Phil Silvers, and Jackie Gleason. But he knew that the networks, not the sponsors, should be controlling the programs, so he insisted on changing the system when he joined NBC.
I wouldn't go to NBC until I got an agreement that I would run television. It would have nothing to do with NBC except accounting, getting money for things. But basically, I had my own controller, my own research department, my own program department, my own sales department, etc. And I wouldn't go until they kind of agreed to do that. And they knew that I would not come unless we could build a program service that we controlled and support it with advertising, like a magazine or a newspaper.
So here you are at NBC. You've decided that now the network will produce the programs, and you had to come up with some ideas of programs to produce. One of your early big successes, I mean one of the biggest successes in the history of TV, really, was your Show of Shows with Sid Caesar. What was the concept behind the program?
Actually, I'd been trying, even at the agency, to build what I called an all-evening structure that would keep people at home on Saturday night instead of doing what they usually did, which is to go to a movie, which in those days, in big theaters at least, would have a stage show. So I had kind of worked out different things, and I went to Max Liebman because I'd gone up to Tamament. It was a resort hotel in the Catskills where Max put on a real new show every week, a complete, not just a couple of stand-up, but a complete show, orchestra, dancers. It was not quite as big as a Broadway show, but very close.
So your concept was to take this nearly Broadway quality review that was at a resort hotel in the Catskills and to bring that to television.
Yeah, but much bigger. We had, like, on that show, we had our main singers, Margaret Piazza and Robert Merrill, were both from the Met, the Metropolitan Opera House. We had the MCs would either be great names from the theater, or they would be people like two or three of the great violin players would come in and host the shows. This is part of the enriching side. We tried to make all shows more than just entertainment. They should have information in them. They should have exposure to the great cultural achievements of mankind, etc. And gradually, we hoped to move the audience to where they wanted to see the whole thing. And we did that with Producer Showcase. I mean, we had 30 million viewers to the entire ballet, The Sleeping Beauty with Margot Fonteyn.
How did Sid Caesar become a part of your show of shows after the Catskill concept?
Well, he worked for Max, and then he'd done some things in the war, and he had been on stage on Broadway by himself, in a review. But he was, you know, Max's pal, and Max was responsible for his explosive greatness, which did happen on Show of Shows.
When you started in broadcasting, you were producing radio shows. Now here you were getting new TV shows on the air. Did you have a sense of what would work on television that was different from what had worked on radio?
No, not really. I believed, you know, when I started in radio, 32, CBS Los Angeles, the Don Lee station there, we had a TV station on the roof, experimental, three sets in the Los Angeles area at that time. and they played old movies, uh-huh. You know, 1932, old movies were pretty old. But what I'm saying is that studying what would happen, we already knew that the cassette was coming, that all these things were coming that would enable us to make the medium have the kind of great world planetary coverage that we had in radio. Because in radio, I don't think you're old enough to remember, but we used to say, come in London, bang, here's Winston Churchill making a speech. Come in Buenos Aires, and on they'd come. That was instantaneous coverage that we knew it would take a long time to get with TV.
So you were sure that television had a future, but did you have a hard time convincing the stars of the time to come over to television?
Very, very hard. They were scared to death of it because they figured, particularly, you know, nightclubs were still very important, and the fear was that if they did their best stuff, they couldn't keep on repeating it. They could in the nightclub, you know, they could do their act, or in vaudeville. But once you go into TV, we have to have all new stuff every week. It was scary for them. I had the worst trouble I think I had was getting Jimmy Durante, who was a big, big, compelling star, to go into All-Star Review, which was the same as Comedy Hour, except the stars there were Danny Thomas. I'd put him in his first radio show as a star, and Ed Wynn, who had lost the strength that he'd had in radio as the fire chief, and Jack Carson, who was an upcoming and very funny guy.
My guest is Pat Weaver, one of the early presidents of NBC TV. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pat Weaver. He's written a memoir about the early days of radio and TV called The Best Seat in the House. One of the things that you created on television was the still-on-the-air Today Show. What was morning television like before the Today Show?
Well, there was almost none of the stations went on the air. A few here and there would have cartoons for kids. That was all. But when I went to NBC, I already mapped out in my head an 18-hour service, which I knew we would have to have in time. And I put off the morning show. And in fact, when I first thought of it, it was going to be just sort of a rise and shine show like we'd done in radio with great success. We knew from our research that 75% of the people turned the radio on in the morning and listened to see if the world was still there. You know, we were having a lot of trouble in the 50s, Korea and the Soviet Union. People were concerned. There were worried and they turn on the radio for that, as well as for other information mm-hmm. about weather and things. And
so that's what you wanted to create on television?
Well, on today, I was going to do an easygoing breakfast club type thing. And there were many successful ones. But because I had to wait, I also got to think more and more about how bad our evening news was and how good it could be on the Today Show, because with the heavy equipment, bulky, you know, a real problem to get to wherever something important was happening, the big story in the States. We couldn't get overseas, really. But we had to take the film and then develop the film and get the film to New York. You know, again, we still didn't have the coaxial cable going from coast to coast. That was 52, but by the time that happened, maybe it was the end of 52.
You say in your book that you had a low opinion of television news when you created the Today Show, but you wanted the Today Show to improve on that. What did you want the show to do?
Well, as I say, we had all night to, one, get to a place where something big was happening. Two, this is with our equipment, and two, we'd have time to get the film and develop the film and fly it back to New York and put it on the show. So we had real coverage that they did not have before then. Before then, really, John Cameron Swayze would read the AP bulletins practically. I mean, that's just what I did in San Francisco when I did the CBS News. I read the AP. I didn't even bother with a writer or write it myself. I just ad-libbed off the AP circus.
The Today Show has a long, proud history. The thing everybody seems to be vaguely embarrassed and uncomfortable about, though, is Fred J. Muggs, the chimp. Did you like the idea of him early on?
Oh, absolutely, the minute I saw him. I was all for all kinds of animals, to keep the kids from turning on cartoons if they were available.
Oh, sure, and there was only one set in the house back in those days.
Yeah, that's right, and it was in the family room. But when they brought Muggs in, it was a baby chimp then, I said, boy, put him on tomorrow. And he was really a great lift. The fact that we had the window for everybody to see the show when television was so new still, and with the set still not anything like it would become within a year. And Muggs, of course, was a tremendous extra addition for people to go and see. All of the kids wanted to go down to 49th Street and look through the window and see the chimp,
mm-hmm.
as well as looking at real television and then, of course, holding up signs.
I guess Dave Garraway wasn't a real big draw to the kids.
Well, he was always very popular, though.
Uh-huh. So you had the Today Show and the Tonight Show, which, of course, is still running two
yeah.
incredible successes.
That was, I put off the Tonight Show, which I had more formalized, actually, even than the Today Show. But I put it off because we had a runaway hit. The first show I did was Broadway Open House, late at night with Jerry Lester and guy that worked for me in California in the olden days, Maury Amsterdam. And Jerry worked three nights and Maury worked two nights, and it was called Broadway Open House, and it just went right through the roof. The ratings weren't very accurate in those days, but we could tell from the mail and from the ratings that it was unbelievable. And that was, what, 11:30, something like that at night.
Mm-hmm. So what was your first vision for The Tonight Show? What did you want the show to be?
I wanted it to be a show that was coverage primarily of entertainment, with any opening we'd cover of the theater, or in those days the clubs were still important. It would be also, it had to be a funny show. And that's when I having worked so long with Fred Allen, the god of my broadcast world, I wanted a funny show. And Steve Allen was doing a local show in which he had some pretty funny stuff. And he had a producer who was a good friend of mine, Bill Harbach. And so I talked to Steve about a structure that would have coverage. And for instance, the opening of the show then was Times Square, which was in those days still the center of the theater world, you know, and the nightclub world. And we, our camera would open on Times Square, and we show the whole of Times Square from the Times building there at the corner. And then the camera would zoom down to a second camera, which would zoom in on the Hudson Theater, which we bought to do the show, really. And Steve would work the audience with a lot of audience gimmicks. And then he had, he had all those wonderful comics who really blossomed on The Tonight Show.
Pat Weaver left NBC in 1956, largely over in-house politics. Since leaving the network, he's run his own program production company and ran an early pay TV operation. His new memoir about the early days of radio and TV is called The Best Seat in the House. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. I'll talk with a Sports Illustrated writer who covers figure skating for the magazine about the prospects for the Olympic competition coming up in Norway and the U.S. team featuring Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding after the attack on Kerrigan last weekend and accusations that Harding's bodyguard may have been involved. Robert Siegel reports on Palestinian plans for housing in the Gaza Strip after the peace accords would go into effect. Mara Liasson reports on President Clinton's day in Moscow, a summit meeting with Presidents Boris Yeltsin and Leonid Kravchuk of Ukraine. And a Hopalong Cassidy Museum in California is closing. I'll talk with the founder about the good old cowboy days.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of the strongest parental instincts is to protect your child. But with more and more children becoming the victims of random violence, commentator Annie Lamott says it's hard to strike a balance between protecting and overprotecting her young son, Sam.
A child was kidnapped and then murdered not long ago in a town 15 minutes up the highway from where Sam and I live. All of us with children still living at home felt a sense of total fear and hopelessness. How are we supposed to protect our kids? How can we show our children that they are safe and welcome here? I was unsure of the answers. All I knew is that I hadn't felt this afraid since I saw The Silence of the Lambs a couple of years ago. I left that movie convinced that I either needed an armed husband or a dog. I opted for the dog. The dog turns out to be Desmond Tutu in a fursuit. Still, she would bark at occasional strangers, and I felt a little safer until this latest murder. Ever since, I've wanted the armed husband, too. Since there are no fiancés on the horizon, my next thought was to have a porch built onto our house so I could sit in a rocking chair on it with a shotgun, like Granny Clampett. My landlord, however, did not want the porch, so I stepped up my general vigilance. I knew this was not the way to go. I was raised by anxious parents and ended up being hypervigilant, like a one-person war room staffed by an extremely tiny, tense stewardess. I hope that Sam grows up feeling more relaxed. But I know now that my parents must have wondered whether they should have had children, too. It feels like we are all bugs on the river, brightly visible to the trout beneath us. And all we can do in the face of it is to enjoy the buggy pleasures. Grab a fleck of river weed, stick together, notice how beautifully our buggy legs scull. I want everything to just stop for a while so I can get my bearings. But life is a no-stopping zone. Sam keeps wanting to play outside. I used to leave him alone when he played out front because he wasn't visible from the street. But on top of everything else, Sam has suddenly made himself more visible. He's created a little fort at the top of the stairs that leads to the road with a small plastic chair and his binoculars. Sometimes he stands on his chair so he can peer out at the street, and when he does, people on the street can peer back at him. Bad people who would steal him. Trout. So now instead of cleaning my house while he plays, I watch him. I told him recently about the real bad guys, not the bad guys in the cartoons, the real bad guys, the ones who take kids, the ones you have to hide from. He looked at me with great excitement. It was like I was warning him about dinosaurs or monsters. He went and got a cushioned rubber band, the kind I use for ponytails, and he showed me how he will use it for a slingshot. He knows the story of David and Goliath, but it's like casting Topo Gigio, the mouse on the old Ed Sullivan show, in the role of David. "It won't work," I said. "The bad men are big, and you are so small." "But I'm so strong," he said fiercely, which he thought was true because I tell him this when he takes his Superman vitamins. He weighs 37 pounds. I smiled at him, but I grieve. So I sit outside now and watch him play in his fort instead of using the time to clean my house or return phone calls. It is all I can think of to do in the face of all the bad guys out there. You can't get your kid a bodyguard. And sometimes it's very frustrating because there is so much to do inside. There are so many moving parts to our life. But Sam needs to play outside. So I watch him, but I don't hover. I take all due precautions, and I ask God to protect him and to teach me little by little to err on the side of my child's independence, because when all is said and done, it is still only treading in the moment that saves us from drowning.
Annie Lamott is the author of Operating Instructions, A Journal of My Son's First Year. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Joan Tuohy, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.